This is Gulf Coast Live. I'm Julie Glenn. Blood donations tend to drop off when high season ends, and in the past, the need for blood saw a bit of a decline as well, but that's no longer the case as more people become year-round residents here. Later in the show, we'll talk about the need for blood and some of the hurdles donors have to clear before giving. But first, the Zika virus made headlines last year when thousands of people across South and Central America contracted the virus, and its links to severe birth defects were first understood. Last year in South Florida, more than 1,000 people contracted the mosquito-borne illness, and so far this year, more than 40 people have gotten it, with confirmed cases in Collier, Broward, and Miami-Dade counties. The CDC still cautions pregnant women from traveling in South Florida. But our understanding of Zika has grown in the past year, both in how it's similar to viruses we've seen before in South Florida, and how the virus came to our shores in the first place. Joining us to discuss their new research and how the Zika virus made it to South Florida, research that's just now being published in the journal Nature for the first time today, are FGCU virologist Sharon Esern and Dr. Scott Michael. Welcome to Gulf Coast Live.
Hi, Julie. How are you?
Hi. Thanks for having us.
We're talking about new research by a team here at FGCU that tracked how the Zika virus first made it to Florida. What are your concerns about Zika? Give us a call and ask our experts at 877-428-8255. That's 877-GCU-TALK. On Facebook, we're at WGCU Public Media, and on Twitter, we're at WGCU using the hashtag GCL. So first, Dr. Sharon Esern, Zika was known for decades before it became a problem, and you've written that the virus was originally from Africa?
Yes, the virus was first isolated in Africa and Uganda back in 1947, and it circulated for decades in Africa. By the 1980s, it had spread beyond Africa to Asia, and it became endemic in areas in Asia. But the very first report outside of Africa and Asia didn't happen until 2007 in Micronesia. And at that point, there were really no associations with what we're seeing now, microcephaly or Guillain-Barré reported. Transmission continued in the Pacific Islands again in 2013 in French Polynesia, and then again in 2014, where it spread to other islands there, New Caledonia, Easter Island, and the Cook Islands. And it wasn't until the early 2015s, that the virus spread to the Americas. It was the first confirmed case of local transmission was in May in 2015 in Brazil. And since then, it has spread to over 48 countries or territories in the Americas.
So when it was making its way across Polynesia and all these different places, they weren't seeing problems like the microcephaly and the huge outbreak?
Not early on. They were seeing some evidence of transmission to babies, but they hadn't really seen any microcephaly. They had seen some cases in adults of the Guillain-Barré syndrome, so neurological problems in adults.
What is? Tell me a little bit more, if you don't mind, about Guillain-Barré syndrome.
It's a neurological symptoms associated sometimes with different viruses. So it's not necessarily unique to Zika, but it happens. It manifests in other ways.
Oh, okay. So, and Dr. Scott Michael, Zika came to many people's attention last year when it exploded in Brazil, and then that link to microcephaly was established. Did something change with that virus to make it spread so quickly once it hit South America, and then have all those serious side effects that we finally saw?
Yeah, we're not quite sure. The microcephaly thing seems to be something new and unique in the Americas. But one of the things that might have been contributed to the rapid spread in the Americas is the naivete of the population. No one in the Americas had ever seen Zika, and so no one had antibodies against it and was immune to it. So if you have a virus that's circulating endemically, locally in one place, most of the time by your early adulthood, you've already been exposed and you have antibodies and you're immune to it. But in Brazil and in the Americas, no one was immune to it. And so it infected all age classes of people, the old, the young, and especially now childbearing women. And that might be the reason why we're seeing these microcephaly cases, is because now for one of the very first times, childbearing women are being infected.
For the first time.
For the first time.
So Did deforestation or habitat destruction or the spread of people into certain areas have any impact on this or getting in front of these mosquitoes that carry this?
Well, that's an interesting question. Possibly the origin of Zika virus is probably from the African rainforests is most likely. And there it might have been a monkey mosquito virus similar to yellow fever or dengue and has these same sort of origins. But the mosquito that transmits Zika, Aedes aegypti, is what's called a peri-domestic mosquito, and it lives right around your house. It's not something that you have to go off into the woods to find. It's breeding and living and biting you right there at home where you live.
So if it wasn't Aedes aegypti that carried Zika, would we be in better shape if it was some strange mosquito that's out in the middle of nowhere that we don't come into contact with?
Sure. Well, let's take a look at another closely related mosquito-transmitted disease, West Nile. West Nile is actually carried by a different kind of mosquito, different species that lives out in the woods and primarily bites birds. And birds are the reservoir for West Nile virus. And it's only when someone happens to wander out into the woods and get bitten by one of these mosquitoes, or perhaps a human biting mosquito happens to bite a bird, that you get these kind of one-off dead-end infections in humans. And humans don't really form the reservoir for the West Nile virus. We're just sort of accidental hosts when the virus breaks out of its usual bird mosquito cycle. But Zika is different. Zika is actually transmitted by these peridomestic mosquitoes that live around human houses. And we as humans are the main host. So when we get outbreaks of Zika, we're going to get big outbreaks as opposed to West Nile where we're going to get a small number of cases just kind of by accident as people find their way into the woods.
And then humans can transmit it to other humans?
Well, Zika is interesting, and we've never seen this before, but it's one of the very few mosquito-transmitted viruses that seems to be transmitted also sexually. And this was described actually decades ago in a research couple, one of whom spent some time in Africa, came home infected and then gave it to his wife, and they wrote a paper on it together and published that.
And so Dr. Isern, there's been a lot of concern about what the Zika virus means for pregnant women and unborn children. But what exactly does Zika do to a pregnant woman that makes it a danger to her child? Like with microcephaly and then other birth defects.
So what could happen there is if a woman is infected with Zika while she is pregnant, the virus can be transmitted from her blood directly through the placenta to the baby. And so as the baby's developing in new cells, the virus has an opportunity to replicate in those cells, and that can lead to birth defects.
And then with adults that are not pregnant, do they have flu-like symptoms if they get Zika, or how does it present itself usually? I think worst case scenario is that Guillain-Barré syndrome,
right?
Correct, which is kind of like paralysis. But then sometimes it kind of exhibits itself in different ways with different people. But the milder symptoms, what do people need to kind of keep an eye out for?
So actually, most people have no symptoms. About 80% of the individuals that get infected don't appear to be infected. They have no symptoms. But the 20% that do exhibit symptoms, they have a fever, headache, malaise. And so very similar symptoms to what you might see with other illnesses, including dengue. There's also some individuals get a rash as well. So sometimes that is one of the ways that you can say that looks like Zika as opposed to something else. But it's a very mild fever illness that doesn't really have much in the way of consequences or complications usually.
And then how does it affect children similarly?
So children, so similarly, right, they're going to have those mild symptoms as well. It's typically the problems seem to arise in utero, so during pregnancy.
That's the main issue. Mm-hmm. But if a child is bitten when they're young and they have Zika, they get Zika, then when they grow up and they're going to have children in the future, is that going to present a problem for them if they become pregnant years later?
That should not present a problem. Zika is not like HIV or herpes where you have it for life. Zika is something, it's an acute virus. You get infected, your body clears it. And so if a young girl gets infected, she's going to clear the virus within several weeks or so and be protected as an older adult. So when she does become pregnant, she will not be able to pass pass the virus to her child because she is immune and will not be transmitting the virus.
Is there any way that somebody can get Zika, not know they have Zika, and then give it to other people?
It's very possible. If you're asymptomatic, it doesn't mean that the virus is not growing or replicating in you. You can still spread it to others. You can get bitten by a mosquito that can then – that mosquito can in turn bite another person and infect that person. You could also potentially transmit it sexually. So just because you have no symptoms doesn't mean that you're not capable of spreading the virus.
And have they determined yet how long the virus stays? Does it kind of depend on the person?
I think it depends on the person. It also depends on where you look for the virus. So in the bloodstream, it seems to not last as long. It looks like in the urine, it lasts for a little bit longer, for several weeks. In semen, it appears to last for several months. And so it really depends maybe on the individual, how much of the virus they were able to basically replicate or grow in the individual. So they're titer, their viremia, and just how quickly they clear it.
I think it'll be interesting to see eventually, too, how different people's physiology affects how it impacts them, too.
Yeah, absolutely.
So Kate in Port Charlotte is saying that she was in French Polynesia. I think this is coming into us from Facebook. And she was there in 2014 when the Zika virus was there, but says that there were no signs or public education efforts there about Zika. And she's wondering if the guests might have any insight into why that would have been the case in French Polynesia, not really letting anybody know, even though it was there in 2014.
I think it was really early on. They didn't really know what was going on. A lot of the education material came to be after the fact when they realized that it was going to be a problem. So I think at the time, Zika symptoms are really similar to dengue symptoms. And so initially, diagnoses was complicated by that. And so most people didn't know they had Zika. They probably thought, physicians thought that they had dengue. That's what they were trained to look for. So I don't think there was really much cause for concern as anything unusual was happening.
And at that point, they hadn't noticed the microcephaly problem either.
That was not obvious at that time, absolutely.
We are talking about the Zika virus, and new research from FGCU virologists to show how the virus first came to South Florida. Give us a call with any questions or comments at 877-428-8255. That's 877-GCU-TALK. And now I want to get into your new research that's coming out today. So first, it looks at how the Zika virus first came to Florida. What did you learn about that?
Well, what we did is we took a look at the genomic sequences of the viruses that were found in Florida and compared them with the genomic sequences of other viruses that were found in the Caribbean, South Central America, and Asia. And what we were able to do with that is map out the entire genetic history of the outbreak in the Americas.
Kind of like Ancestry.com for Zika.
Exactly.
Tracing it back.
Exactly. So we used the virus's own genetics to trace how the virus spread. And what we were able to find, number one, is that oftentimes the virus was probably present well before it was clinically diagnosed.
Right.
Present in the place?
In Florida. So we were looking – so our studies we try to answer a few questions. The first one was, when did Zika come to Florida? So when was it introduced? And that's what Scott's referring to. So we know that the first detection in people, clinical cases, was around July. And so did the virus show up then, or was it present in Florida before then? And what our study shows is that it was probably here at least early that spring of 2016, so before there were any human cases reported. We also looked at how many times did Zika come to Florida. Was it a one-time thing? It was brought in either, by an infected person that got bitten that started the local transmission, or did this happen several times? And what the study found, that it did happen several times. It looks like, Florida was getting hit multiple times, and at least four of those times it took off, meaning that local transmission started. And so it wasn't just a one-time thing. It was, multiple introductions occurring, and then they would fizzle out, then a new one come in and fizzle out. But it was, Florida was getting bombarded by Zika from different places. And that leads to the question of, so where does Zika come from? So we now have it in Florida. Did it come originally from, the South Pacific? Did it come from Asia? Did it come from Africa? Did it come from Brazil? And what our studies showed was that from three of the four different introductions into Florida, those were from the Caribbean, and the fourth one was from Central America. So we were getting introductions from these different places. we were able to confirm that Zika was in Florida. And the only way you can really do that is not just looking at infected people, because if you're infected, you could have traveled, right, and just kind of brought it with you. The only way to know for sure is if the local mosquito population also has Zika. And so we were able to find that the same virus that was in the mosquitoes was also in the infected individuals in areas. Primarily, this is the Miami Beach areas where we were found the infected mosquitoes. And that correlated, that basically proved that Zika was now endemic or habitually present in Florida.
And so how did it first get here, though? Did it come by way of a person who had Zika that came to Florida, or was it a wayward mosquito?
That is an excellent question. We don't have the answer to that. It's really possible that a mosquito could have gotten trapped in a container or a tire or in an airplane and come right out, or someone went somewhere traveled either through cruise ships or through airplanes and brought – was infected and then became infected locally, gotten bitten locally by a mosquito, and that mosquito was then able to start the chain of transmission to other people.
Can you, I'll turn to Dr. Scott Michael, can you explain how a virus that lives inside of a little mosquito that doesn't live very long, how's it able to establish itself in a new area like that? Is it because of the human host population?
It is, exactly. So these mosquitoes, these Aedes aegypti mosquitoes, they live around human habitation. And they'll bite you as you're having your morning coffee. They'll bite you when you go to work if you work in an open-air setting. And that's where many of these outbreaks were in Miami. They were oftentimes in open-area settings. And so what happens is if an infected person travels and gets infected in another country and then comes back to Florida, the mosquito vector, Aedes aegypti, lives here already, and that could bite that person. Then the mosquito itself would become infected with Zika virus and go off and lay eggs, and some of those eggs might be infected. So then you'll have a new generation of mosquitoes that are now infected. And then that mosquito, every time it's getting ready to lay another set of eggs, they bite another person, get another blood meal. And every time they do that, they have the potential to transmit the virus that's in their saliva now to another human. And then that cycle just keeps repeating, human, mosquito, until you get you could get a very large infected population.
So when mosquitoes, these Aedes aegypti, when they reproduce, it's a lot of eggs at a time, I'm imagining.
Yeah, thousands. And their eggs can they usually lay their eggs just above where the water line would be in any small container, piece of trash, gutter, wherever around your house. And what will happen then is when the rains come, the water level rises up and wets the eggs, and then the eggs hatch and live in that water. And they can actually overwinter like that.
Hmm. So you got to pour out the water and any kind of standing water around your house.
You really do. You have to. That's mosquito control, and especially the ability to control those breeding sites is key.
And for that particular type of mosquito.
Absolutely.
So we've had 285 local transmissions last year. And it's kind of hard to know if it's from mosquito bites or if it's been passed sexually from person to person. It's difficult to understand that. And now we've had 40-plus local transmissions this year. Do you believe that those 40-plus transmissions this year are because of mosquitoes that laid their eggs last year, overwintered, and those got wet?
Well, actually, the transmissions that we've had in Florida have been from people that have traveled to places that have Zika. So we have yet to have local transmission in Florida. That hasn't happened yet.
2017.
So we've got 40 in 2017, and those are all related to travel.
To travel, yes, absolutely. But one of the things that we found in our study was that we can determine based on the abundance of mosquitoes and how many people are infected, you know, how long will one particular sort of outbreak last for? And you can sort of determine, so if one person is infected, if that one person can at least infect another person via a mosquito or however that person gets infected, you can say that the epidemic continues, right? So I infect you, you infect Scott, and we continue in that way. But if one person can only infect, say, half of a person or a fraction of a person, meaning that that transmission is not super productive, then the epidemic dies down. And so what we found here in Florida was that number is less than one, meaning that the transmission started, right, but then it didn't continue. It maybe lasted for about 100 days and then fizzled out. Then that got taken over by new introduction that also fizzled out in about 100 days, and then a new one and a new one. This is different than what is seen in Brazil, where each individual person, if you do these same types of calculations, is able to then infect three other people. So that leads to an increase in the number of infected individuals and so the epidemic increases as opposed to goes down. And so that's a good thing for Florida, in that what we're seeing is that mosquito control efforts are doing an excellent job in finding where the infected mosquitoes are. So as these mosquito pools were tested for Zika, mosquito control in Miami-Dade County went after them and eliminated those mosquitoes in the area, and that went a long way in stopping the transmission of Zika in Florida.
Does that speak at all to the immunity of people in Florida versus the immunity of people in Brazil, though?
Not necessarily, because the people in Brazil also had not been exposed to Zika as the people in Florida. I think maybe that is more of a consequence of mosquito abundance and the ability to just get rid of that intermediate vector.
I think that our knowledge of it from Brazil also might have, tipped us off, and our preparedness was right up there.
Absolutely. Florida was not taken by surprise. Florida was ready, on the lookout to see when and where it was going to start, and was already on alert.
So you both researched mosquito-borne viruses similar to Zika. How does your background with something like dengue fever help you to understand Zika?
Well, dengue and Zika are actually very closely related. They're both transmitted by the same kinds of mosquitoes. They're both in the same family of viruses, and they share a lot of immunological overlap. So one of the problems with Zika testing was that most of the early tests that people did wouldn't be able to distinguish between an infection with dengue from Zika. So they're close enough related that there's a lot of similarities. And we've done dengue virus research for more than a decade here in Florida. We followed the dengue outbreak in Key West in 2009, 2010. Mm-hmm. And then there was another outbreak in Port St. Lucie. And that was in 2014.
13.
Sorry, I'm getting my dates mixed up. And so you can look at the dengue outbreaks in Florida and compare them to the Zika outbreak that's occurred this past year. And it's sort of the same sort of thing. So the two dengue outbreaks, these major dengue outbreaks, were from different sources. And then they eventually fizzled out over the course of a year or two. And we'll have to see how long it takes to whether or not we get Zika back this year. But there's a lot of similarities between dengue and Zika.
Does exposure to dengue make you more or less susceptible to Zika?
Oh, that's a great question. So it turns out that there are four different kinds, four strains, if you will, of dengue virus. And if you get infected with one of them, it protects you from that strain but not the other three. And as a matter of fact, the antibodies from that first infection, they can make you sicker if you get infected with one of the other ones. And this is a phenomenon called antibody-dependent enhancement, where these non-neutralizing but cross-reactive antibodies actually drag the virus into other cells, macrophages and the like, and increase the amount of viral replication, which then can make you sicker. And this is pretty well established in dengue. But our lab was the first to show actually that antibodies against dengue can also cross-react and provide this same sort of antibody-dependent enhancement with Zika. So there's a possibility that if you have a previous exposure history to dengue, you could get more severe symptoms from a Zika infection, although this hasn't been confirmed clinically yet. No one's been able to do those studies yet.
But it looks that way based on the research that you've done so far.
Yeah.
Does Zika evolve, and does it become, I'm thinking about like the flu virus, for example, and there's all different kinds of flu. Are there all different kinds of Zika?
Zika is evolving like any other virus. It's an RNA virus, but it does not do the big jumps that influenza does in that for influenza. Every year you need a new vaccine because the circulating strains change that much. It doesn't seem like that's going to be the case for Zika based on how it replicates, but it does mutate a little bit. And so that is how we were able to do our study, by looking at the changes that the virus makes and being able to track when and where it was located during those changes.
But it's still the same old Zika. It just has slight variations based on its travel.
Absolutely the same old Zika, yes.
That pesky Zika. So you've both been grant-funded to find a dengue vaccine. So, and you previously worked on antiviral treatments for dengue fever. Tell me a little bit the difference between an antiviral treatment and a preventative vaccine.
So a preventative vaccine is something that you take to keep you from getting sick or getting the disease. So it's the shots that you take, the flu shots that prevent you or usually from getting the flu. But a treatment is something that you take once you've already been infected to treat the symptoms so that you feel better quicker. But it doesn't prevent you from getting ill.
And it doesn't make the virus go away.
No. Like for influenza, you can take Tamiflu after you've gotten infected with influenza, as opposed to getting the influenza vaccine that should prevent you from getting the flu.
Yeah, it's always the worst when you go to the doctor and they say, oh, it's a virus. Okay, we can't do anything. But could any of the antiviral treatments for dengue be used for Zika?
There are none. So no one has developed a successful antiviral against dengue or against Zika. There's a lot of people working on that, and we're in that mix.
But if one were developed for dengue, for example, could that possibly also be applied to Zika? Do they kind of act the same?
Yes, absolutely. There's a lot of overlap between the functions of the different viral genes. So if you make something that inhibits dengue virus, it's very likely that it might inhibit Zika as well, and vice versa.
And we were talking earlier about the origins of Zika. We were talking about how it was in places for a long time, and they weren't seeing problems with microcephaly and the problems with the babies, if nobody's familiar with microcephaly too well, but the birth defect effects and things like that. They didn't have those problems in these places where they'd had Zika around since the 1940s, like you mentioned. Is Florida eventually going to be a kind of place that just has Zika around, but we have developed immunity because we've had it around for so long?
Right. Absolutely. That is a possibility. So what's happened in Africa and Asia, where people get infected when they're young, they develop immunity for life. And so as more and more people get infected, say in Florida, then you're going to be protected if you get Zika as a child. As a young woman, once if you're having babies, you will not be able to transmit the virus to your children. And so it's going to become a disease of the young. So as Zika comes back during the if it continues to come back during the wet season, that's when the mosquitoes are most abundant. That's when transmission is going to occur. But older generations that have had prior exposure are going to be protected.
So, but the problem is getting through that period of getting the Zika spread around enough to where we've developed that kind of immunity.
And that might take a while. I don't know if that's a matter of, several years or a decade. I don't know how long that is going to be, but
That might not actually ever occur if we keep having these outbreaks that are self-limited. They spark and we get a small chain of maybe up to 100 or a few hundred cases, and then they burn themselves out. We may never establish enough herd immunity in the population to prevent further introductions.
And this is similar to what has been seen with dengue. We get those sporadic spurts, little outbreaks in the Keys and in different places, but they fizzle out. And so a large percentage of the Florida population is yet not immune to dengue because it hasn't hit our shores that often.
Well, and the other problem with Florida, too, with all of our visitors that come down from up north, they're not going to have that kind of immunity. I mean, it would have to be, coast to coast and every person developing that kind of immunity. So I guess the vigilance on keeping these mosquitoes in control is...
Right, the vigilance. And then also the advances that will be made in Zika vaccine development. At some point, we hope to have a vaccine available where people can then be protected.
Well, I look forward to having the follow-up interview when you guys come back and tell me about the vaccine you've developed in order to deal with that.
Not quite there yet.
Not there, but we'll definitely have you back on when you get it done. That's positive thinking. Well, we're going to have to leave it there because we've run out of time, but I want to tell you I appreciate you coming in and talking with us. FGCU virologist Sharon Isern and Dr. Scott Michael, their new research into how the Zika virus first made it to South Florida is being published in the journal Nature today. Thank you for joining us.
Thank you.
You.
Coming up, the need for blood is holding steady through the summer months, but the amount of people here to donate drops every year. We'll talk about the need for blood donors and learn more about how it's tested for viruses like Zika and HIV/AIDS. I'm Julie Glenn, and this is Gulf Coast Live. Stay with us.